Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What goes into creating outdoor urban spaces that invite visitors to explore and connect with their surroundings? My guest today has spent 5 decades designing such environments, from the Nasher Sculpture Center and the University of Texas at Dallas to the Sony Center in Berlin and the National 9/11 Memorial at the site of Ground Zero in New York City. Peter Walker is founder of Peter Walker and Partners Landscape Architecture. He's in town to take part in the Longing for Beauty Conference at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. We are delighted he could make time to be here this afternoon. Peter, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
The 9/11 Memorial was dedicated just about 2 months ago. Did you have any direct connection with 9/11 before you were attached to the project?
No, but we were attached to the project maybe 2 years. We began to be involved in it maybe 2 years after the attack, and only about a year after the cleanup, which went on a long time.
Mm-hmm. It's been a decade, which in some ways feels like forever, and yet it's still such a recent moment in American history. Do you have to approach a project like this in a different way, given that the memory of what happened is still so fresh for people?
Yes, you do. I mean, there are really two kinds of memorials. I used to teach memorials at Harvard, so I know about this. There's the kind where you, right after, where you're still in shock, you determine you're going to do something to commemorate this. And then there's the kind that comes 20 or 30 years later. I'll give you a couple of examples. The bombing in Oklahoma City, they insisted on doing it immediately. And mm-hmm. I was on an NEA panel that went out there, and we listened to the people, and it's, you know, it's horrendous, you know, the way they feel, and they've lost relatives and friends. And we decided that the level of emotionalism was too great, and our panel recommended that they wait 5 years and then take up the subject when people had, you know, sort of sorted things out a little bit. And that recommendation went into the city fathers. But the city rejected that idea out of hand. They just simply wouldn't do it. They wanted to do it right now. They were feeling so bad. They wanted closure. And the memorial in New York is like that. The other one would be, let's say, the Roosevelt Memorial, where mm-hmm. he had left in his will instructions for what he wanted. And he wanted a stone on Pennsylvania Avenue just about the size of his desk in the White House. And that stone is there, although no one sees it. I don't mm-hmm. think anyone that I know has ever – I have been there, but no one really goes there. And when Lawrence Halpern had a chance to do this, who's my old boss and a mentor, I asked him about it before we did this. And I said, well, how did you deal with this thing? And he said, well, you know, the Roosevelt family had objected to every larger thing that was being proposed. And he said, you know, I just didn't really take that into account. I decided I was going to be working for the American people and for the people of the world who wanted to remember Roosevelt in a certain way, wanted more information about it, and wanted a place to go to feel those things, learn a little bit about that, and to experience that. And he said, I just didn't take the family into account. On the other hand, we had 3,000 families.
Yeah.
And they were very strongly political. They were not unified. I mean, mm-hmm. they weren't a client in the sense that they voted or anything. But I met many of them, and they really wanted an immediate response. And you know, 10 years seems like a long time, but it's immediate in terms of the political process. And this is a very large project. It just took that long to mm-hmm. do. It's not finished yet. We're only half done.
I want to talk about the trees that went into this, because you didn't simply go to a nursery and say, okay, put these things in the ground and in 5 years I'll be back to take delivery. Talk about how these things were selected.
Yeah, well, I wish we could have done that. First, New York is a very tough place to plant trees, not just on tops of buildings, but anywhere. Mm-hmm. The average tree in New York lives between 7 or 10 years. Very, very short life. And the reason for that is that New York has so much radiation full of particulates, you know, the cars, everything, you know, is going on. And the trees aren't planted very well anywhere in the city. maybe Central Park's an exception, or some of the larger parks
where they get deep roots and
where they have deep roots and where they have a kind of natural condition with, you know, water and soil and feeding and all of that. So when we talked to the people at Cornell who are the experts in urban trees, they said there are really only 6 or 7 trees that they would recommend being planted in New York. And because the stress is so great on them, just like stress on you or me, you're much more prone to catch a disease, to go into shock, all of those things. And even if the trees don't die, they just sort of sit there. So they only gave us a choice of 6. And of the 6, the swamp white oaks were the only ones that we felt could do the job, not physiologically, but more in terms of the way they would look and what we wanted to do with it, and their lifespan. Because we wanted, you know, not 8 to 10 years, we wanted 80 to 100 years.
And eight to 10 is the average.
That's the average.
Yeah, urban trees.
So when Governor Pataki wanted to have the trees come from the 5 states that were surrounding, where most of the people who had been killed came from, New Jersey, Maryland, so forth. And so we went out in those states, and there were no nurseries in those 5 states that had anywhere. We needed 500 trees, which is 415 plus enough to replace for replacement during construction, because very difficult construction. And so we couldn't find them in one place, and we couldn't find them in one size. So we had to go out and select. And we had a forester named Paul Cowie who works with us, and our staff went out, and we found the 500 trees. Some of them were in nurseries. Some of them were in farmers' fields and were dug specially, just like the Nasha. We dug many of those trees out of farmers' fields. Some of them were given to us by Public Works Department that volunteered because they wanted to be part of it and gave them to us for free. So those trees came from all over the place, and our staff did a really good job of finding trees that looked alike. But when we boxed them up and got them all into New Jersey, into a nursery area, which was about the same location to the rivers as downtown New York, it wasn't an urban site, but it was close in ecological terms. And when we got them out there, they were very much alike, but they were all different sizes. So we got the Bartlett tree people, who are wonderful. I mean, they know, they're like doctors for the tree. And they hooked up each tree intravenously. And they starved the big ones and fed the little ones. So in the 3 years that we thought we were going to have before we planted them, they brought them up to being almost identical. I've never worked with so many trees that were in such perfect condition at that time. Of course, we ultimately were 3 years behind. So even the first trees were only 5 years, were 5 years when they should have been in those boxes for 3. So after the 3 years, they had to slow them down again because we didn't want to put them in larger boxes so that they wouldn't become root bound. So it was a very complicated system. Interesting. And I've never been through anything quite like that. Generally, we do go out and get trees somewhere, and they bring them and put them in. But this one, we were living with them. It was like a nursery is a good metaphor for that.
When you talk about living with something, I mean, when a building architect puts in a structure, for the most part, it stays the same year in and year out, season in and season out. You have to think about, will there be, you know, will the leaves change color? Will they scatter on the ground? Will things be alive in the winter? Can you talk about how much that plays into your thinking?
Oh, well, a great deal. But it doesn't seem so strange to me. These were all deciduous trees, so they had seasonal change. And one of the things I tried to do was to tell the clients, and there were multiple clients, tell the clients what was so wonderful about these trees, that, you know, in the early spring when you have the rain, they would come out and leaf out in bright green leaves, you know, and you'd see the water, because it was raining, you'd see the water on the stone, and you'd see these trees in their bright green. And then in the summer, they would virtually fill out the whole area, and you'd have complete shade. Then in the fall, of course, at the time of 9/11, they would start turning color and start dying. And then in the winter, the leaves would all fall, and when you needed sun in the park and on the plazas, the sun would come through this sort of tracery, and then the bare branches threw a completely different kind of shadow on the ground. And New York's cold in the winter, and so you want that sun. And so I was trying to explain to people how what a wonderful thing that is. I mean, it's kind of a miracle each year. Then in addition, of course, the trees grow, and so they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then there'll be a time, I won't see it, it'll be 80 years from now, 70 or 80 years, where they'll start declining. And like an old person, you know, they have a certain kind of beauty, you know, when they're in their decline. And so there's this whole range of things one has to imagine. And I spend a lot of time explaining to clients why this is so wonderful, why it's a terrific thing to have, and why just a tree isn't just a tree. It's a much more marvelous thing than a green thing outside the, you know, your window.
In a city, well, I guess in any urban environment, really, but New York in particular, which is so tall, there is the view from the ground and on the ground, and then there's also the ability to take the whole thing in from above.
Absolutely. Well, it's like sculpture. You know, the thing about sculpture is that you walk around it. And sculptors spend a lot of time thinking about that surrounding move. And I spend time with that. We're also inside. It has an architectural component because when you're in this grove, you're actually inside it. But I also think a lot, whenever we're doing a city thing, I think, what are you looking down on? Mm-hmm. And we had several things we were trying to make clear. One was these voids, which represent the loss of the buildings, and then the trees are constantly changing. And so you'll get a different view in the middle of the winter, a different view in spring. And the same thing is working from above as is working down below, except that you're seeing it as a separate thing, like a painting, perhaps. And that's a really important aspect of this.
And this is also a space that, in a city so densely populated, the residents of New York City are going to pass through it and use it on a regular basis. It's not only a place for solemn reflection for everyone.
That's right. That was one of the reasons I think we won. The mayor particularly said that, look, this is a memorial, and we have to give, you know, due importance to that. But at the same time, this is one of the densest neighborhoods in the world, and this needs to be a public open space. You know, there's Battery Park City, which has some park areas in it all along the waterfront. There's Battery Park, which is just below it. But this is 7 acres, and that's, you know, in New York, that's a significant open space. I mean, it's larger than Bryant Park. It's larger than anything in the city except, you know, maybe Central Park itself. So he said, you have to think of both of these things. And I remember when we were finally being interviewed by the jury, and the woman who was on the jury from the mayor's office, she said, can you make both of these things work? Of course, we were petitioners, and we said, of course we can. Yeah. But that was the difference. That was what made it work, because Michael Arad, who was the architect on the thing, had gotten to the point where they really loved the voids. They loved the metaphor. They loved the vision of them. But they didn't love 7 acres of stone, which is what he originally. And it would have been grim. Winter and summer, it would have been really grim.
Broiling or freezing.
That's right. And the jury then said, you know, you need to talk to a landscape architect. And I knew a number of the people. I knew Maya Lin very well and so forth. And I suspect she told Michael, at least you ought to talk to Pete.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like people who visit need permission to use the park for other things, and that's where you come in.
Well, right now you have to get tickets to go in, and you need permission. But you won't need that. Anyone can walk in at any time, 24/7, and there's not going to be any restrictions at all. It will be policed, but it will be done fairly discreetly. We have, you know, cameras all over, and we have police who are walking around. We're very conscious of the fact that it's not a target as big as the World Trade Center was, but it's so significant. It's been built, you know, and given so much importance that they are worried about security.
Peter Walker is my guest. He is founder of Peter Walker & Partners Landscape Architecture. He's in town to take part in the Longing for Beauty Conference of the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is landscape architect Peter Walker. His projects include the National 9/11 Memorial, the Sony Center in Berlin, and Nasher Sculpture Center. He's in town to take part in the Longing for Beauty Conference at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak on the phones now to Margaret in Carrollton. Hello, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Margaret.
I just wanted to tell Mr. Walker I was just up in New York, and we had the joy of going to the memorial and spending quite a bit of the day just walking around, and just how beautiful and peaceful it is. And I just felt that, you know, what a big part the trees play, and just how cleansing the whole feeling there is. It just, you can't help but feel very calm and at peace there. And I just so much appreciate what he, how he participated in what's happening there, and how beautiful it is.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted you go there. Landscape needs to be seen on the site. It's an art of milieu, and there's no way of photographing it. There's no way of writing about it or describing it that comes anywhere near being there. So I'm delighted with your reaction.
How do you make the call on any project, not just the 9/11 Memorial, about when your work should simply complement what else is there and when it needs to really draw attention to itself?
Well, I think landscape is always in a complementary position. It's a question of what it's complementing. Sometimes it's setting something up. The memorial is that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a place that something is in, some like sculpture, where you're really doing a kind of stage, and then the sculpture becomes the player. You want to provide scale and comfort and beauty, but you want the sculpture to be the actor. Sometimes, like in a park, you're dealing with recreation, and you want to form a contrast. If it's an urban situation, think of Central Park. The real wonder of Central Park is the contrast between urban life and the park, not some complementary thing within the park, but mm-hmm. that major change. I mean, it's remarkable because you have these 40-story buildings all the way around, everybody looking down, and then when you get in the park, you look back and you see the city around you. Nasher Sculpture Garden has that. It has the sculpture, but there's also the city, you know, coming up around you. And I find that a really beautiful thing and fun to work with, fun to think about.
Let's talk about Nasher, because for the most part, the garden is sort of hidden from street view. There are these walls all around, but there is this one window on the south side that allows for a glimpse inside. What was the thinking there?
Well, I'd like to think that there's more than one window. Renzo Piano, the architect, and we worked with this notion that the building itself has a series of walls. And if you look at the garden, you'll realize that the hedges are extensions of those walls, not just the walls around the garden, but the pieces inside the mm-hmm. garden. And that is what divides it up so that you can have larger pieces and smaller pieces and so forth. But we intended when you walk down Flora that you would look in and you would see what was going on inside the building, but you would look through it because the building isn't very deep, and you would see a hint of what was going on deeper into the garden. Now that there are windows actually on both sides, and now that the new park is coming, there'll be some indication of the garden from the outside, from the park side. Not very many people are down there now, but when they're in the new park, they will see it that way. They're not going to see it all. It's not going to be a picture window with a lamp or anything, mm-hmm. but it's going to indicate that something is there. And I think our idea, both in terms of looking through the building and also the windows on the side, are sort of a mysterious. They give you a partial view and essentially say, well, if you want to see more, come on in.
So clearly you and Renzo Piano worked very well together. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the back and forth sort of trading of ideas and maybe trade-offs that you both had to make.
Well, it's true in every project. I love working with a really good architect, and I love working with someone who is mature and who has ideas. But I also like the best idea to win, and sometimes you do a little battle. I think Ray Nasher really put it pretty well. He said, you know, Renzo has a big ego. And he says, Pete has a big ego. And he says, but you know, I've got a big ego. So it was a wonderful experience, not quiet, but wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, I guess you knew that the works of art that were within the garden would change from time to time, or at least some of them would.
Yes, it's not a museum in the sense of a permanent collection. Many sculpture gardens are like that. You can go in and you will see the same thing every time. It's a gallery. And we knew, I think Ray had several hundred museum quality pieces. I mean, superb pieces. But the garden can only hold 23, depending on the size, can only hold 23 or 25. So every piece in that garden, including, you know, maybe someday the Sarah, will be in and out. Ray used to have it around his house. He had 5 acres. And you'd walk out, and every time you'd walk out, it'd be a slightly different combination. They wouldn't change entirely, but they would change very slowly through time. So every time I go back to the Nasher, I not only see a different show within the building, but I also see a slightly changing show, additions, subtractions, and so forth as it goes through. And I think that makes it one of the most unique museums in the world. Many museums you go back to see the same thing each time. And I love museums. I'm a museum person, and I know exactly where the paintings I want to see are in the various museums that I'm a member of or that I visit when I'm overseas. But this one isn't like that. This one is constantly changing, and it really shouldn't be called a museum. It's a gallery.
This might seem like a banal question to you, and if it is, I apologize. But you also have to consider the fact that there is foot traffic on and around the things that you have, the soft items that you've put in place. I mean, is that a source of stress? Do you simply put a place in plan and trust that it will be maintained appropriately? Not in the Nasher only, but anywhere.
Well, the Nasher is an exception. It's maintained fantastically. Mm-hmm. And I come several times a year. We have a wonderful horticulturist named Robert Moon, who's a local. The staff there takes care of it beautifully. The pieces themselves have not posed that kind of problem. There are some pieces that children love and love to run around. And I'm, you know, if the grass is worn off now and again, I don't you really have any trouble with that. It's the popularity for various activities, which has posed a challenge. And we've been working on that now for 4 or 5 years to try and do things which don't change the quality of it, but make it a little less susceptible to damage from all the parties and weddings and bar mitzvahs and so forth that are there. So it is a problem. I suspect if we had put more emphasis in the programming of it, that we were going to have so many. My guess is it wouldn't have been quite this way. But because people love it the way it is, the Nashers have continued to maintain it and take on all the activity that is asked of it, which is a nice thing. It's a community space.
What role do models play in your design process?
We make models. We made 13 models of the and Renzo made a number of models of the Nasher. We finally ended up with two. I gave one of them to Ray so that we made him models of all of his pieces so he could play
Oh, wow.
With them. He could place them like a dollhouse.
Finally,
you know?
He can touch the art. Yeah.
Right, and then we kept one, mm-hmm. You know, and we use it in our office. We, you know, show people and we think about it and so forth. So we make a lot of models. On the memorial, we made models which were huge. They were 10 feet square, and they were large enough so you could look underneath the trees, because I was very concerned about this flat plane that the voids are cut into, and that was really important. So we would work with furniture, and we'd place more furniture or less furniture, and we'd have people in there. We would have more people and less people. So we tried to, very much like a stage set, we were trying to figure out all the various combinations and make the very best decisions we could. And the Nasher's no different.
We have an email here from Andrew who asks that you would talk about the University of Texas at Dallas. Andrew says it is the most overlooked architectural achievement in the Dallas area.
Well, I hope in time, it's fairly new, I hope in time it won't be quite so overlooked. Margaret McDermott and Ray Nasher came to us, and we were interviewed, and they hired us. And what they wanted was to take a series of buildings that had been built over the last 30 or 40 years that were not distinguished. Any one of them was not very distinguished. There's one really good building, the McDermott Library is quite beautiful, but the other buildings are middling, not looked a little more like an industrial park than it looked like a university.
I heard the architectural style described as brutalism. Is that actually a term?
Yes, it's a term. Their architecture is concrete. The basic material is concrete, exposed aggregate, sort of concrete, soft, you know. And then all the windows are dark gray.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something you probably wouldn't require if you were thinking of it. I think of University of Virginia Jefferson's. If he had had that those same buildings, you wouldn't probably even think much about UVA today. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what we were asked to do was to provide, and we weren't told exactly how to do this, but provide a setting where people who had gone to this university would not have the remembrance of, or the memory of, this banal, dark, you know, dull place. And also to make it unique so that this would go along next to the other great universities in Texas and elsewhere, so that we were not using symbols and forms which would remind you, you know, not like Harvard, not like MIT, not like SMU, you know, always something different. So I got to know Mrs. McDermott really well, and she took, you know, she's been very active in the Botanic Garden, and so she took me through there. And when she was describing this thing, she said, oh, look at those flowers. Aren't they beautiful, Pete? You know, and we went all through it. We went several times. We went once in the rain, which was very beautiful. So I started thinking that how to make this thing unique was to use magnolias rather than elms or oaks or something to make the major forms, because mm-hmm. they would flower. And I thought that was, you know, that idea came from her, not saying, why don't you use magnolias, but showing me that she really liked flowers. I'm always trying to deal with a client on their own terms as much as I can, because that makes things personal and unique. So that was the way we started out with this thing. And then to do it in a monumental way that when you came into the university, you would see enough, and it would be particular enough, so that when you went away, a visitor, but certainly the people who went to school there, and they would go away with that thing in their head. And it's like the old section in Austin of the University of Texas at Austin, that part up on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
It's like going in the Harvard Yard or the great court at MIT or the great lawn at UVA. I wanted something like that was unique unto itself. And I wanted it to be, in a way, something that would immediately impress itself on the students that were there, and, of course, all the students that would follow.
Are you wanting people who went there before to come away with a new memory that sort of replaces what was not as attractive in the past?
Well, we've been told that. Several people have come up to me and said, you know, I was here, and this is transforming. You know, it was such a dull place. So it was, you know, that's one of the ideas. But I'm more thinking about the future. I'm more thinking about people who come through, and schools today need their alumni. Schools mm-hmm. need the support. They need financial support, but they also need people referring students to them and speaking about the school in glowing terms. This is a marvelous school, has wonderful faculty, and has wonderful students. I mean, very, very high-level students. But they had no place. And what we tried to do is make a place that they could associate with all the other good things that they were getting there.
When you talked about Margaret McDermott and her love of flowers and the magnolias, which smell so very good, it made me realize that those of us who come to the work that you do as consumers rather than as professionals, we think of it as essentially a visual medium. But you're also managing what it smells like and how sound is absorbed or magnified and what the ground feels like underfoot. Can you talk about the different senses that you're considering when you go into a design?
Well, all of the things that you've mentioned, certainly smell, shadow, you know, the moment you're there, it's different throughout the day, it's different throughout the year, not just the trees, but the place itself. I love to use water out in the open because I love the reflection of the sky, mm-hmm. which is always different at different times of the day, but also different times. Every day is different. So there is a kind of changing quality sort of vivacity, which is partly the trees, but it's also these other things too. And I try to do things in a very simple way so that you will be aware of the things that I'd like you to see, rather than having a rather complex and maybe confusing series of experiences, which are a little hard to lock into a memory.
Mm-hmm. How do you make decisions about something as simple as where to put seating and where to assume that you'll just have pedestrian traffic?
Well, in a university, you need seating everywhere, mm-hmm. because you have to think of your own university experience. It's not unlike a park, but it's different. You need to have a place where you can sit and read. You know, you have to have a place where you can sit and think. You have to have a place where you can sit and not think. You know, all of the kinds of things. You have to have a place where people can talk. You have to have a place where people can argue. You have to have a place where people can wait for someone. All of those very human activities, because you're locked into this campus, and you have to take care of everything.
A whole life is lived there.
A whole life for a period is lived there. And the more places you can touch someone, the more service you can give them, the better they will feel about it and the stronger their memories. Because their memory is not just of the place alone, but it's all the things that happened to you when you were there. And so I tend to put a lot of places that are formal that you can sit on. I try to put a lot of places that are informal that you can sit off. The pools are made because I know students will go in the pool. I also know that they'll put soap suds, you know, in the pool.
Several times a year.
And I want them to. You uh-huh. know, I want them to go through all of that kind of experience, because those are the things that they'll take with them when they leave the university, along with all the other things that the university gives them.
Landscape architect Peter Walker is my guest. He's in town to take part in the Longing for Beauty Conference at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with landscape architect Peter Walker, founder of Peter Walker & Partners Landscape Architecture, whose projects include the National 9/11 Memorial, the Sony Center in Berlin, and the Nasher Sculpture Center Garden. He's in town to take part in the Longing for Beauty Conference at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join us, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Peter, you talked about your recognition that soap suds will be in the fountains and that people will splash around after midnight after having too many beers on a college campus. I suppose that really has to be part of your thinking. You can have this grand design, but if people don't choose to use it the way you want to use it, it's useless.
Yeah, it's still. I remember when I first got out of Harvard, I just graduated as a young landscape architect, and I was asked by my partner then, who was a teacher of mine, to go out to San Francisco and open up an office to do a particular project called Foothill College, and right near Stanford, out behind Stanford. And I didn't know anything, you know, and I knew I didn't know anything. So what I would do on the weekends is I would go out and look at projects. And I first started thinking about, you know, how do you build a bench? How do you do this? How do you make a pool? All of that kind of stuff. And I had a young family at that time. I had three young boys. And I would take them with me, you know, so that my wife could have a day off. And we'd go out. And I would look at these things, and I look at the benches and so forth. And then I started looking at how my kids reacted to these various things, which things they were interested in, which things they weren't interested in, what they got up on, what they jumped on, going into pools, all the mm-hmm. things we've been talking about. And that led me into a really a lifetime of looking not just at how children use places, but how everyone uses places. And when I design, though the designs seem to be very simple, they're calculated because they're based on how I know people will use things. It's not to say that I'm never fooled or that I'm not surprised by some new thing would happen, but I like to think that the places are there for those people. And I like to think about the ways they might use them. College campuses, for instance, I don't think you should have a pool that you don't want a kid in. I mean, you have hot summers that they ought to be able to take off their shoes. They ought to be able to get in. They ought to be able to throw each other around in them. I mean, that's what college kids do. And so they get all wet and they have to go back to the dorm and change their clothes. They're perfectly good with that. Or maybe they don't change their clothes. They just dry off. So I think all of that stuff makes these things more human. And I think the people who have done the best landscapes in the long run are the people who have that knowledge, or perhaps more importantly, have that interest in that area of knowledge.
Do you find that clients are more receptive to that idea today than they were when you were starting out?
Well, I'm not sure I always tell them what I'm doing. there's a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. Public spaces now, because of ADA, which is an important thing, but because of safety and the legal implications, people are concerned about that. And so you have to play that game within the rules of what is legally viable. And the clients are concerned about that, but when you do describe this to them, they can see the magic in that. They can see how people engaging something is better than people just looking at something.
It sounds like an off-label use for a prescription medication. Theoretically, no one's supposed to get in the fountain, but it's designed so that if it happens, it's okay.
That's right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Pam in Dallas. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
Hi, Pam. Go ahead, please.
Hello,
Pam. Go right ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. It's a real pleasure to talk with you, Mr. Walker. I just wanted to comment on how astoundingly beautiful the Nasher Sculpture Center is. It is just breathtaking, and we so enjoyed seeing it for the first time last weekend. And I was—I just love your use of all the different materials, and especially the way that the wood and the stone, the kind of the wood walkway and the stone and the reflecting pool are all very flush, but the change in textures is just gorgeous.
Well, thank you. You know, one of the things about a gallery as opposed to a museum is that there's a lot of different kinds of sculpture. And sculpture is different in terms of its intellectual content, but it's also different in terms of its scale. And they go all the way from things that are truly monumental, like the Desuvero or like the Serra, which are really big. I mean, you could put them in a parking lot and you'd see them because they're really grand. All the way down to very small, almost intellectually complex things like the Liechtenstein. You know, there are pieces in there that you have to bring down in scale. And so if you come through the museum, which generally has pieces from, let's say, human size down to pieces that are small, that are lifted up on setting pieces. And then out into the very large pieces, we're in what I call the top of the garden. And then going down to the bottom of the garden, where the scale gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And so those little pieces have an environment just for them that is more intimate, that shows them off to better advantage. And if you'll notice in the garden, the places to sit, the informal places to sit, are down in the bottom of the garden where you can contemplate. And the other places to sit are up off the cafe, out on the terrace. And you can sit and see the big things from a distance. And at the bottom of the garden, you can sit and see the small things right up close. And the plinths are set around in those long stone things that are sort of benches. Those are set around, again, to be informal benches, but also to be places for sculpture. Sometimes they'll place a sculpture on that. And it's this variety of spaces In a museum, if you were trying to do this, you could put up temporary walls to make spaces for the various sculptures that the curators wanted to place. But outdoors, you can't change those walls so easily. So what we've done is made a variety of spaces that could take a variety of sculpture as they're turned over. There are never more than 25 or 30 pieces in the garden at any one time, and yet it seems full. And that's the idea.
How do you decide on what lighting is proper for a particular design?
Are we talking about the Nasher, or are we talking about other things?
I think in general. I think people may be familiar with the Nasher, but just as a general question.
Yeah. Well, of course, Nasher is a gallery, and so you have to set up lighting just as you would inside a museum. And we have the lights up in the trees, and we have a capacity to put lights down low. So any show can be set up and lit, you know, for the show itself, for the pieces that are there.
So the lighting is flexible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's say in the memorial, we have lights which are placed up in the trees. An awful lot of what we're doing in the memorial is to get the place cleared out and yet not have it look empty. And so the lights there are placed up in the trees, so they light the lower leaves of the trees, a very beautiful soft light coming from above. And then they're lensed in such a way that they throw a soft light out over the paths so that you're not getting bright pieces of light as you go through, but rather you're lighting this thing in a soft way, because we're not trying to, you know, to shock you. We're trying to actually make something that's very calm, that horizontal plane is emphasized, and then when you come to the voids and the fountains, you will, you know, have this contrast, this vertical contrast to the horizontal line. So all the things in there, lighting included, are tuned down. If you notice, the benches are tuned down. They're not something that are calling attention to themselves. And that, you know, a lot of that is simply much more restrained because of the nature of the project.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to James in Wichita Falls. Hi, James.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, very well, thank you.
Hey, my question was, have you ever designed anything that ended up being used different than what you intended it to be used for?
Everything. I'm constantly amazed. Universities are a very good case in point. I'm constantly amazed at how, no matter how much I think about it, no matter how much I scheme to make people, you know, behave in a certain way, they behave in other ways. And people really do change. The Nasher is a good case in point. I always in my mind had the idea, and whenever I talked to Ray Arenzo about this, you know, this was to be a very contemplative, very quiet place. But you have to go down there when they're having a wedding or when they're having a birthday party or a bar mitzvah. It's not a quiet place.
It's a
festival.
Laughter.
It's festival grounds. And I don't think any of us thought about that as much as we should have at the beginning. And as I said earlier, we're making subtle changes to make that more possible and to reduce the damage.
You have worked all over the world, and I'm curious about how you take an American sensibility and make it work in Germany or Japan or anywhere else.
Well, you do a number of things. One is you don't try to be German, you don't try to be Japanese, you don't try to be Chinese. On the other hand, when you go into a place that's new, you have observations and you have views of things that are different from people who live there. Part of that is cultural, part of that is visual, part of that is scale. Sometimes it's plant material. So one has to take seriously the different climates, the different areas of plant growth. Otherwise, they die. So you have to – those change. But I also have a real interest in those cultures, but I don't pretend that I'm an expert in them or that I know them. I play off them as a neophyte, as a newcomer, and I try to do something that's fresh within that framework. I go around and look at what people who are in that country do and how they operate. And I would say it's even cities in the United States. I mean, places are different. Nebraska is different. Texas is different. New York is different. So I watch and go around and see how people operate and what kinds of things they like. And then I do my own take on that, not ignoring that, but playing against it.
Obviously, you cannot use the same materials from place to place. Are there certain things that you love to come back to when they will work in the climate?
Yeah, I mean, we typically are remote, so we can't be running around there fixing things right. all the time. So I do try and use things that will work. I'm not very adventuresome because I don't want things to die. I don't want them to have to change that quickly, which is not to say that we aren't wrong. You know, there are climates and then there are microclimates, mm-hmm. and you may put a plant in a particular place and it's getting a little more wind than you had expected, or it's getting more radiation, or it's bouncing off the building behind. So there always are surprises with living things. But my view of a garden is very much like a family. You know, you have to take care of it. It's not the design that's the crucial item. It's the tending. It's the gardening that's crucial. I mean, you have to imagine having children and not paying any attention to them. That's sort of what happens in a garden. And a garden can go away in just a few years. When I was younger, I did a whole series of things in housing. And basically, you were working for developers and they wanted to sell them.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd get something that looked wonderful in the first year or two, and then they'd sell them, and then people wouldn't take care of them. And often we would get a call to come down and look at it because it had gone to pot. And you'd have to tell them, look, they've let these plants go in such a way that we're going to have to take them all out and start over again. And you could just, you know, the homeowners association said, you know, they were crestfallen, you know.
I wanted to spray something and have it all come back.
That's right. Or maybe a wand.
That's got to be heartbreaking, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And you hate to see something that's destroyed. Landscape is very fragile. And even the best of us, even the most careful ones of us, lose gardens because all you have to do is ignore them for a few years. I'm always, you know, I like fountains. I love to work with water. And then you'll see the city, you know, there'll be a water shortage. And even though the fountain is recirculating, they'll turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
And turning a fountain off, turning the pumps off, means that they don't come back. It's the worst thing you can do. You're supposed to keep running them. They'll last longer if you keep running them. On the other hand, plant material, if you turn the water off, they die.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you know, you'd think people would know. But we used to be an agrarian society. Everybody lived on the farm. Now we have, 3% of the people who live on the farm. And we have many immigrants who come from agrarian societies. And they're much more sensible and much better clients when they have this background. But we are now an urban society, and our experience of growing things is by and large suburban, and that's not the same as watching a field grow and watching a crop come back, which I love. I mean, those are the landscapes that I feel very, very strongly about.
Do you get much time to tend your own garden at home?
I live in a loft. I do have a garden in our summer house, and I have to admit we're fairly neglectful because we don't go there as much as I would like.
Mm-hmm. Peter Walker is a landscape architect and founder of Peter Walker Partners Landscape Architecture. His projects include the National 9/11 Memorial, the Sony Center in Berlin, the University of Texas at Dallas, and Nasher Sculpture Center. He's in town to take part in the Longing for Beauty Conference at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Peter, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Been a lot of fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.